At Amica Insurance, we know it's more than a life policy. It's about the promise and the responsibility that comes with being a new parent. Being there day and night. And building a plan for tomorrow, today. For the ones you'll always look out for, trust Amica Life Insurance. Amica. Empathy is our best policy.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour, and they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit truegreen.com, TRUGREEN.com, to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Looking for a fun way to win 25 times your money this football and basketball season? Test your skills on Prize Picks, the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projection for a wide variety of stats, and place your entry. It's as easy as that. If you have the skills, you can turn $10 into $250 with just a few taps. Easy gameplay, quick withdrawals, and injury insurance on your picks are what make Prize Picks the number one daily fantasy sports app. Ready to test your skills? Join the Prize Picks community of more than 7 million players who have already signed up. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit up to $100. Just visit prizepicks.com/play100 and use code play100. That's code play100 at prizepicks.com/play100 for a first deposit match up to $100. Prize Picks, daily fantasy sports made easy.
This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Wagon Wheel Podcast. I'm your host, Jared Kimber, and this show is part of the 99.94 Network. On this show, we record weekly with questions from the audience. This podcast is funded by Patreon, which you can join by clicking a link in the show notes. And there are many other benefits, but one of which is to ask questions first on this show. Let us start with Kennedy, who says, do you think javeliners would be able to transfer well to fast bowling? So fast bowling is quite interesting. I had an American athlete recently. I think he was an NFL player. He was a college footballer who knew he probably wasn't going to go on to the NFL, who said he was going to, wondering if he could become a fast bowler. And I couldn't think of a person who had become a fast bowler who hadn't bowled, you know, before the age of 15 or 16. So it to me seems to be something that is maybe a little bit more unique. I remember having a fight with a scientist, but he may not have been, but it was someone to do with academics. And he was saying that China could go from nowhere to the world's best test team in 5 years. And I was saying, you can't, because a lot of the things that you do in cricket are completely alien if you have not played cricket. Whereas there are other things where, you know, you might be able to modify a jump or a throw or anything else for some other sports. But in cricket specifically, it does seem that there needs to be an accrued level of knowledge that comes up with cricket, you know, that is passed down by generations, which is why we see generations slowly get better and then get to a certain point. And we don't see flare up nations very much. And the only one that we've really seen ever is Afghanistan. And to be fair, a vast majority of their cricketers actually grew up in a country with all that knowledge already there. Even if you want to look at Ireland, you know, their golden generation, so many of their players grew up playing in county cricket as well, or going to school in England, or whatever that may be. So I have heard a theory that, from fast bowling coaches, that suggests that javelin throwers could do that. I've also heard a theory that bowlers should run in a little bit more like javelin throwers as well. So that is the one I've heard the most of. I don't really see it. As far as like what elite performers of other sports you think would transfer well into cricket, the tennis players, I suppose in some ways, a tennis player is maybe a little bit too tall now. Perhaps, you know, tennis players of a previous generation when, you know, cricketers and tennis players, even then batters were smaller, weren't they? So I'm not sure about that. Yeah, that's a really interesting one. Obviously, baseball fielders and cricket would be quite handy, but you're not going to have a specialist fielder. I don't know. It's such a peculiar sport in so many different ways. It'd be very hard if you had a baseball background to work out cricket, whereas I think it would be easier, although obviously we've seen a couple of pro cricketers not make it in baseball, but I think it would be slightly easier to go the other direction. I think it would be hard to say that, say, Chris Lynn or Adam Gilchrist, Andre Russell, those sorts of players, you know, if at 25 or 26 they wanted to cross over, I think it would be easier for them to cross over than it would be for Mike Trout to cross over into cricket. So tennis players is an interesting one because it has some of the best athletes in the world, and you have to have great hand-eye coordination. You also have to read the path of the ball when it's going up in the air. So it's a bit like cricket, you know, if the hand goes to this side or the ball goes to this side, you have to be reading the everything. That's very similar against cricket, which obviously baseball has as well. I don't know. There's if you haven't played and you're like a 20-year-old, let's say there was someone like Alex Carey who came from another sport, but let's pretend Alex Carey had never played before. And he's 20 and we suddenly put him in and he comes from Aussie Rules football and he's a great athlete and he's got a great attitude and he works really hard. There's just so many things to learn. I'm not sure it's, you know, a particularly easy sport to do that. Whereas clearly we've seen, you know, other sports where you can be a very late learner and pick them up. Good question though. And what a way to start. What an opener. Thank you, Kennedy. Not that I picked it because it's an opener, just it's where AJ put it on the list. Satchmo says, Viv Richards averaged 62 in March 1981, but 50 when he retired. He averaged 42.85 in the last 10 years. Does this indicate a significant decline? Now, if you want a significant decline, I think you want to look at his last 3 years. I don't think he averaged 35 in the last 3 years. I'm trying to remember now. I really struggled at the end. It was certainly, that's the real decline era. I think if you look at Richards' record, it's wild how inconsistent he is. It's not how we think about him now, but I think this is right. He makes 1,710 runs in 11 tests in 1975 or 1976. And then next year, I think he averages less than 29. And part of it is probably the schedules that he played and how he went. The interesting thing you talk about there, 1981, he dominates one-day cricket for 5 or 6 years at that point. And I mean, all-time dominating. Like, you know, it might have been the best one-day player we've ever had at times in that period. And so if he's declining, it's really weird that it's not happening in both. My guess is that a lot of it is just the weird schedules that they played. But if you really want something interesting that I did find, I think from 1975 to 1982 or 83, he plays around 25 to 30 ODIs. He then plays almost that many the following year or that year. And then from then on in, he's playing 25 to 30 ODIs. But obviously, the tests sort of go up and down. Some years he only plays 3 tests, and other years he plays 11 and 12 and these sorts of numbers. So the numbers that really vary in the tests, whereas in the ODIs, once he starts playing a lot of ODI cricket, he just absolutely smashes it everywhere. So I don't think there was a decline until the end. Certainly, he's a player who probably averages 53, 54 maybe, if he retires when it was obvious that he was past his best. Ricky Ponting, probably another player that did that. You could argue Sachin was maybe another player that did that. The absolute greats kind of have to call it quits themselves, right? Or they go on and on. And I think in that situation, it would be fair to say that he probably went on a little bit more than he should have. I have one other really, really good point when it comes to all this that I've forgotten what it is. But I do think when you change your style, when you change your load management and everything else, it does affect what you specifically get good at. He seems to have taken one day cricket, just from his numbers, he seems to have taken one day cricket a little bit seriously, more seriously than anyone else. And so throwing himself into so many games a year, some of the games totals he had is phenomenal for that era, does suggest that he was changing his outlook on cricket a little bit, and maybe that affected it. The only other thing I would say is late 70s to early 80s, my guess is bowling attacks get maybe that's not true though. Actually, maybe the late 70s is actually one of the tougher periods. There is a period in his career where it was bad. My overall point would be, if he finishes with an average of 50, he certainly played through a tougher era. If you batted from 2000 to 2015, like someone like Kumar Sangakkara, you have a phenomenal record because that is a great batting era. That doesn't mean that Kumar Sangakkara is not great. It means that his numbers look a little bit better because of that era. Bradman and George Headley probably have similar inflation, Wally Hammond as well. Whereas you have to then do the opposite. So for players like Javed Mean, Dad, Alan Border, Martin Crowe, those sort of greats from late 70s through to early 90s, even to mid-late 90s, really tough to keep that average above 50 for any of them, right? It's just not something that happens that much, unless you're Imran Khan, apparently. But hey, he's out of control. Renee says, what could the ceiling be for Washington Sundar? I think he has more ability than Jadeja or Ashwin when they started. I don't know if I agree with that. Right now, I don't see India using him properly. They're still treating him like a project player rather than giving him more responsibility. Okay. I'm trying to think of how old Ashwin was when I first saw him. 2008. Yeah, he's certainly not more talented as a bowler than young Ashwin, I don't think. Jadeja's a bit weird as a bowler, but obviously as a batter was probably better than Sundar. He made, 93 triple 100, test triple 100, first class triple 100s by that point. So, yeah, take that in any direction that you want from that perspective. But I wouldn't say he was more talented than either of them. What I would say at the moment is he's a tall off spinner, and they have a tall off spinner who's better than him, who's maybe not as good a batter in all conditions, but certainly in certain conditions is a very good batter. Brilliant strategy as well. The sort of person you want around your team. I'm not saying that Sundar can't turn into that, but very few young players are at that level automatically. Look, you won't find many people. I bought him at a very, very young age. It says he's 21. He must be older than 21, surely. Don't want to look up his age, but you did say that, Renee. It doesn't feel like he's 21, but I think he's a little bit older than that, but maybe you're right. I bought him in 2018 when I was with RCB and was saying to them, you have to get this guy. What are you doing? I'm trying to remember the player it was. They were also looking at that stage, but clearly he was the one that they needed to be involved with. They never quite got him. I don't think India have quite got him either, but to be fair to India, Akshar Patel, Ravi Jadeja, R. Ashwin, just your finger spinners alone, all have batting talent as well. I'm not sure that they need to do anything particularly silly with him. My big thing would be he just needs to play overseas as much as possible. Get him overseas as much as possible. Let's see what he develops into. Probably try and get him a county season. Certainly play as much A cricket as possible. in a perfect world, you'd want him to play in some overseas T20 leagues. That's obviously not going to happen. But that's how I would want to develop him. But I certainly don't think he'll be as good a player as Jadeja or Ashwin. But I'm only saying that because they're two absolute, you know, Indian greats, and not that far away from being all-time greats. You could probably already make, if they both retired now, you'd have to make a pretty good argument for both of them, especially with latter half Jadeja's career. And Ashwin is just an absolute master of what he does. To say that Sundar has that in him, I don't know. I kind of feel like he does because I do rate him that highly. But I do wonder over a long period of time if his bowling is quite strong enough and his batting is quite strong enough. I just want him to have one locked in skill where I'm like, great, we can bat at number six, or great, your automatic first spinner. And at the moment, I just feel like he's neither of those things. But young all-rounders talk about it on this podcast all the time, right? It takes time to develop. So usually you would have a situation with like Jadeja or Vettori, Ben Stokes, where you're like, yeah, well, he can develop because Sundar just feels just a step below that. But I think he's a fantastic talent. And there's no rush, I suppose, is the other thing. You've got incredible players around him. In fact, having him on tour with them, coming off the, you know, they come off the field and you ask them why they did what they just did. All those sorts of things count. James says, do you think that neutral umpiring at international level has had cascading effects to improving umpiring at lower levels? Or is it purely up to the governing bodies at those levels? Look, I don't know if umpiring at club levels is any better. Last time I played club cricket in England, it was not particularly good. What I would say is this. I think DRS changed the way we think about LBWs. That certainly, from having played a little bit of club cricket, has seeped into it a little bit more at lower levels. I think having international, neutral umpiring in international cricket is just an easy win and a simple situation, and takes the heat out of political tensions and everything else. I think, but more importantly, it's less about the neutral umpiring at international level. And I think what actually has had the effect is having a system of professional umpires who then filter back down to lower levels and coach people. And there's obviously a lot better training available. I think before there wasn't maybe there wasn't really a reason to have great umpires. I know that sounds stupid, but I'm not sure you would have ever invested in it or worried about it. You would just hope someone got good and then you would pick them more often. And we know that the quality of umpiring in places like Pakistan and Australia was pretty poor. India, probably another one. There were certain countries where, for whatever reason, good umpires weren't coming through. New Zealand maybe is another one as well. Some were biased, and then there was natural biases put through and everything else. But there's a big difference between that and the professional level of umpires, I think, come through now, and the training. That all comes from the neutral umpires, from the ICC having to pay for that pool. But I don't think the actual neutral side of it makes a difference, if that's specifically what your question is. Christian says, really interesting to hear you talking about Temba Bavuma's ODI success. What's the future for players whose best format is 50 overs? It's quite interesting. Would they be better off trying to improve their white ball or red ball games if there isn't a long-term future in ODIs? Well, white ball is ODI, but I think you need T20 or test, which is fair. He's not going to drop off. Well, I mean, he has improved his test game. So in his particular case, he's probably going to hang around a little bit as a test batter. So I don't think that's the end of the world. I certainly think that there is enough money in certain countries, at least, in certainly following that. Like, if you can be a average to slightly better than average test player and a, you know, plus ODI player, you should still get county contracts and you'll still get international contracts. There still should be positions for you, and then, you know, finances that back that up. If we're talking about in 10 years' time where World Cups are the only, only major one day is at a left, I think at that point, yeah, you're probably fair, Christian. You have to make a decision between, the two different formats. I think we will see players make decisions between the formats more and more, just because if you're a slightly above average player, and you want to build a very, very long career, splitting your time between the three formats means you're probably not preparing yourself as well. And I suppose with someone like what Chris Lynn has done recently, watch the video, you have the ability late in career to still pivot if you need to, if there's still other options around. Will says, what sort of test career numbers would Gilchrist have had if he wasn't in a weaker team or is required to bat at number four or number five? My memory is that Gilchrist has really good first-class numbers batting at number four or number five. Probably also depends on what age he comes in, because there's no way a see, this is the big thing with Gilchrist. His numbers are partial. He's got the Adam Voges bump, right? That's not his fault. He was fantastic, Gilchrist, especially the first, 60% of his career? The second part of his career wasn't that much better than a sort of most modern wicketkeepers. Maybe that's unfair, but he was a plus, but he certainly wasn't the player he was at the start of his career. I think he averaged close to 60 for a long period there. But he came in at a peak age when he was available. So the first thing you would say is, if he came in earlier, he would have come in earlier, like way earlier, because they would have needed him. Weaker team would have needed his batting. Forget about his wicket keeping. So he would have come in. What I would say is that he played a number seven role perfectly. We know that he could bat up the order, because I think I'm right in saying he certainly batted up the order in first class cricket at times, certainly for New South Wales, and even as a keeper in WA, although they had a stacked batting lineup. I think even there he came a little bit higher up in the order. So I don't think that would have been the issue for him. Interestingly enough, I think he would have developed very differently. I'm not sure he stops being an attacking player, but I do think that once he got worked out, I don't want to say we're just talking about Viv Richards. At a certain point, once people understood where to bowl to him, there was a chance, you know. And if that happens when he's 22 and 23, he has the chance to develop that. That probably happened to him when he was 31, 32, is my guess. I'd have to go back and have a look at the years. At that stage, it would be very hard for him to change what he was doing. Also, he was given a license. So I think he probably does average less if he's batting at four or five in a weaker team. I think he comes in earlier. I actually think he's probably a more well-rounded player and would probably be of more, he wouldn't have as good a numbers, but probably would have been of more worth to a team at that point. You know, there were series and situations where Adam Gilchrist wasn't useful. You know, we saw moments in India where, you know, the off spin completely bothered him. Again, you're talking about a player who came into international cricket at 28, and from the whacker, suddenly playing, you know, in Sri Lanka and India and those sorts of situations was going to give him problems, especially in the red ball game. England coming around the wicket, moving the ball away from him, you know, angling it in, which is funny because kind of that's what everyone does to all left-handers now. So we now know it was in a Gilchrist weakness, but maybe just a left-hander's weakness. But again, it's a similar kind of thing that you're talking about, which is he comes in and he didn't have to develop anything. Firstly, he's batting at number seven. He comes in with a few bad situations, but he comes in with a great amount of situations. He also has a license to attack, which gives him that. He would be a completely different player if he played in a weaker team. He would have come in earlier. He would have batted higher up the order. He would have developed much better. I don't think he would have had a good 3 or 4 years and then, you know, a couple of bad years at the end. It would have been a completely different curve from him from beginning to end. So it's a really hard question to answer. I would say you would have to knock some runs off his average. But I still think he would be attacking if he came in at another time. If he batted early. I don't think you knock that out of him. I think that was just part of his... It was different to KP, the way that he went about it, but I think it was part of his defense was attacking. And so, you know, him slowing down wasn't necessarily going to work for him.
I'm not sure if there is a hairier sport than cricket. From the early greats W.G. Grace and the demon Fred Spofforth onwards, cricket has always been hirsute. Boom, Gooch and Dev with their upper lip work. Shoaib and Imran's incredible manes. Not to mention Lily's incredible chest rug. Our sport loves curated hair. And so does Manscaped. They just look after the bit that you can't see. So if you want a cricket-inspired downstairs pubic mustache, we can think of no item better than the Lawnmower 4.0 from Manscaped. Whether you're steaming in from the ladies' end or mounting a strenuous rear guard, always put your trust in Manscaped, who will look after your lower order. So go to manscaped.com and buy their kit with my red Inca code, all one word, and get yourself 20% off and make yourself 20% sexier.
Bloody Bugger says, gambling sponsors are rare in cricket, YouTube, social media compared to other sports. Closest thing I know is the Betfair podcast. Why do you think this is the case? Would you personally consider a gambling sponsor? Feels like there could be some good integrations.
I've never been offered one. It depends on the gambling sponsor and what they would do. Actually, I was offered a deal with Paddy Power a few years ago. Must have been after I left Crick Info. But they wanted me to write on their website. Write on your website. Paddy Power's website. Just seems weird. Anyway, I offered them a piece about Mitchell Starc as a saber-toothed tiger. They didn't want it. So from that, it hasn't come in. Betway, is it Betway? I think that's what they're called, have sponsored KP, and they sponsored a few other cricketers. I got something from Steve Harmison the other day, although his wasn't a direct sponsorship from a gambling place, but a gambling place used his comments. I don't understand how those things work. I have issues with gambling, but at a certain point, fantasy sports is gambling, and I've taken money from those before. So I don't have a problem with the gambling industry and cricket and match fixing the way that a lot of people do. And the reason I don't is gambling industry, the legal gambling industry, that is, it's one of the best defenses to fixing that we have, because they know everything about the markets and they they certainly provide feedback to boards and the ICC at times about matches and about anomalies and everything else, because they don't want to be ripped off either. So I don't have a problem from that perspective. I'm not a big fan of gambling. I think for me, you know, at 99.94, if a gambling network was to come along, it would shore up our future. So, you know, if we get a big idea like that, it would be the case. My guess is the reason that hasn't happened though, mate, is because it's gambling is illegal in many cricket markets, and also it's hard to get gambling licenses that, you know, right across the market in the same way that perhaps you do in other sports. That would be my assumption of why it's happened. But I've been absolutely fascinated. As someone grew up following American sports, where if they ever talked about gambling, they kind of had to like couch it in many other discussions, to suddenly just like gambling is out there and, you know, talking about favorites and, you know, organizations like the Action Network who are basically writing about sports from a gambling perspective. It's really, really fascinating, the kind of information that you could get. And actually, come to think of it, when I had Cricket with Balls, I certainly had some gambling sponsorship. So that was, in those days, that was about all you could get on blogs and everything else. But the integrations you talk about, that's why I was thinking about the American stuff. There are some really interesting things. And if you look at my work, I quite often put the odds up just so that, you know, you could say, but this is what the market is saying at the moment. The World Cup was fascinating. You know, watching the market moving around as it was quite a random World Cup, wasn't it? You know, teams winning, losing, you know, England end up being favorite and then the island game happens, all those things. And so I do find it fascinating, and I'm certainly not against it. Has to be the right company, has to be the right amount of money, all those sorts of things. But that's kind of the case with most advertisers. To be honest, you know, I've been offered weight loss pills. And I said no because I didn't feel comfortable at it as someone who was once overweight. It just didn't feel right. And I think we kind of know that they're a scam, and also selling weight loss pills on the internet. You know, you have to weigh up every advertiser, and there might be another company that offers me a different product at one time. We had some of the, is it CBD? One of the CBD companies was in touch recently and talking about sponsorship. I don't know that much about it, but you know, I'm happily do some research and have a look at those sorts of things. So, you know, I'm running a startup. This is YouTube is one part, and then the podcast is one or two parts, I suppose, of the startup. You've got the 99.94 things. You've got my email, sports writing course, all these different things. It's very hard at this stage when you're not backed by a major company to not take it, but you also have to be smart. You know, there's a brand part of it. But as far as I can tell, in cricket, it's just mostly to do with probably the Indian market and the betting there. The fact that there aren't that many companies that probably have, you know, betting licenses in the majority of the cricket nations would be my other guess. Gary says, with no island players having played any real red ball cricket in the last two or three years, would it actually be a sensible choice to try and emulate baseball in the test against Bangladesh? Well, having seen them play white ball cricket, I'm not sure. I'm not sure that would be the method I'd go with, Gary.
I'm assuming they've played some first class cricket. I haven't looked at the how much, but there must be some. But you make a point there of, you know, they might want to look at it slightly differently. But you know, you're talking about a team that had Andy McBride batting at number three, right? And probably three or four players, almost everyone was shifted up one spot or two spots at certain times. That's not comparable to what we saw in England. You know, you're not talking about Joe Root, Ben Stokes, Johnny Bairstow, you know, those sorts of players in your middle order. So I don't think it's directly comparable. But I understand your overall point. It's a really interesting thing of how Ireland prepare for one-off tests every now and again when they don't play that much cricket. It's hard to develop your skills, but it's hard to maintain them and everything else. Excuse me, everyone, and everything else. So, I don't see them being able to do baseball. But hey, if they do, it'll be fun. So they should do that. I sent Andy a message. Lee says Alex Hales is planning to miss England's Bangladesh tour to play in the PSL, which Nasser said is understandable. Yep, a player's always paid the money promised in these T20 leagues. IPL, PSL, maybe yes. I don't know about the PSL. I think most of the payments have been done, but I think there are still players owed money by IPL teams. Not many, to be fair, anymore. There was when I wrote an article for the Cricket Info with The Guardian about it. That was only a couple of years ago. Is there any chance the players missing international cricket for Mickey Mouse T20 leagues are actually worse off? So the money usually arrives. The problem with those Mickey Mouse leagues that you're talking about is when it arrives. That is usually the bigger issue. And then also, quite often, in some locations, and the UAE is probably one of them, if you want to get your money guaranteed, they give it to you in cash, which, of course, is usually too big an amount to take back into your country. I think an international player might have... Well, actually, it wasn't even an international player. I think a domestic player might have got caught bringing back too much cash into his country at one stage. Certainly, I've heard of incredible stories where even media members have been asked by players, can you just take this big wad of cash into the country for me? You know, players stuffing money down their underwear. I know this all sounds stupid, but this has happened. So yes, it's an issue. Usually the money comes, but it's really, really late, is what I would say. Maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 months after. Players are getting slightly better now where if they don't... Players are now getting paid during the tournament, little installments. You usually get, I don't know, 60 to 70%, maybe even 80% of your money up front. The last payment, depending on the league, you can expect to wait for it. I'm not going to lie. I mean, look, I'm still owed money for work I've done in cricket, and I won't get that money. So what you are saying makes a lot of sense. It's a real Wild West. This is my problem with it, and I've written about this. I might have even done a video on here before, but you have to get a no objection certificate from your cricket board to be able to go and play in one of these leagues. Fine. That you go and get, so I don't know, you're a Bangladesh player, you go and get an NOC and you can now play in a New Zealand league. You go to New Zealand, probably not the best one, I think they pay, but you go to New Zealand and you play and they don't pay you. Who do you go to? You would think you would go back to your board who has given, no, they don't want anything to do with it. Generally, let's say New Zealand wants a franchise league. You go back to their league, and they'll be like their board, and they'll be like, "Well, don't want anything to do with it." So you're stuck with the player. So you're stuck with the owner in that situation, which means New Zealand was the absolute wrong place to pick. You know, it's a terrible situation to be in. I think some leagues have started doing escrow beforehand, but yeah. Certainly when I was working in leagues, it was absolutely horrendous, which is why I've written about it so much. I mean, it has happened to me. I don't think there are many people who've played or coached or worked in multiple leagues that aren't still owed money by someone. So it is an issue. Kennedy says, how do you think teams would fare if India were allowed to field two teams at any time for international tournament? I mean, you know, we had this with the Australia A, didn't we, back in the 90s? So I think India would be pretty good. I always worry in that situation about when you have fast bowling injuries. So the Australia A situation is really interesting because obviously Australia A were destroying England and Zimbabwe
they beat Australia in one of the games and then played them in the finals, and Australia picked Paul Rifle to be their 12th man in the final so that he wouldn't have to bowl against them. Let's imagine he was just injured. Those sorts of things happen. I think it was Paul Rifle. I hope I've got those details right. That's my memory of it all anyway. One or two bowling injuries, even, you know, the crop that India have or the crop that, you know, England or Australia have had, New Zealand. Once you start thinning it out and you've got, you know, four fast bowlers here and four fast bowlers there, you're getting to your eighth and ninth bowlers, you get a couple of injuries in there. And I do think that's when the team would struggle. Don't think they would struggle for spin. They shouldn't struggle for batting or wicket keepers or anything else. But it's usually just that from memory. Maybe the West Indies side, but then again, I don't think their batting was strong enough outside that main core of players. So they might have struggled with their batting. But the West Indies would have been a really interesting one in the 80s. Sylvester Clark, you know, Roddy Eswick, Colin Croft, all those sorts of players, especially in the point when Kirtley and Courtney are fit. Oh, no, maybe that's not right, because by then the rest of the bowls have gone out. Yeah, probably have to be early 80s. Yeah, I think it's just really tough. I think I've proved that with my weird maths there. James says, do you think Australia's decision to play and not forfeit Afghanistan in the T20 World Cup undermines their refusal to play bilaterals on ethical grounds? Do you think other countries will follow suit and eventually create similar situations to South Africa, or will Australia be out there on their own? I haven't heard any other countries massively interested in it at the moment. Probably don't play Afghanistan enough for it to be an issue. Do I think it undermines them? Yeah, I mean, it's a bit like India-Pakistan, right? Like, you're still playing them. I don't really understand it. If you're not going to play them, don't play them at all and take all the repercussions. You say what you want about the Sri Lankan cricket team. They refused to play Israel in a World Cup qualifier once. And that's 1979, kids, if you want to go Google that. I haven't heard of anyone else being massively aware of it. It's a story that's obviously happened, and I've been at a distance from it and haven't been following it that closely. I think in cricket, there's so many weird political angles that you could take. It's a really interesting one if we start to open it up. I think there's a lot of countries that would be interesting from that point of view. What if a country said that they didn't want to play Australia or England because they're offboarding refugees? You know, refusing to have legal refugees in the country. It's a bit tricky. It's a hard one to justify as well. Like, do you know what I mean? Most countries have something, except maybe New Zealand. I don't know. They probably have something. I've missed it. Ian says, having watched South Africa win the ODI series versus England, how likely is it that they manage to still mess it up versus the Netherlands? And if you were the Netherlands coach, how would you go about being the banana skin? Look, I think South Africa played really good cricket against England, and obviously England's a much better team than the Netherlands. I didn't watch that series thinking, oh, South Africa cricket is solved. Watch that series thinking that their batters got away with what they got away with. I would think that having watched the Netherlands, that South Africa is so much better. There's nothing specifically Ryan Campbell. Is he back in charge? I think he's back in charge. Could do from that perspective to be able to, I don't think there's anything obvious anyway in me watching them. The most obvious thing is, can you attack with three or four slips and get them three down for 50 or 60, knowing that their two batters then are going to have to, you know, play within themselves for a long time because they're going to be a little bit terrified of losing more wickets that they bat at number seven. I don't think that's anything different than Netherlands would do, though, than what England would do. But maybe if you really wanted to risk it and they're batting first, you know, you have three slips or two slips in a gully or whatever situation, and really, really try and attack them. Again, that also depends on, you know, maybe someone like Van Meekeren being fit and available to bowl for them. But hey, they've done it once. Have another go at it. Christopher says, how would you be looking at an England 11 for the World Cup? Is Rashid, then a Livingston, Ali, enough spin? Well, they can also, I mean, Will Jackson's an interesting one there. And am I missing, is there someone else who can bowl spin? And obviously Joe Root is the other option there. I think Stokes will play. I think he will come back. And I think they will pick him. So that will also help a little bit with those middle overs. well, you know, the fifth bowler overs. So from that perspective, you'll have, would you be able to have Root, Ali, Livingston? Yeah, I don't know where Livingston fits into that. I think it's really interesting from that thinking, but they will be able to squeeze some out of Root as well. So they do have flexibility if they need it from that perspective. But I would think that they would pick Stokes. I think I'd find it hard not to pick Stokes, if we're being honest. Renee says, the T. Natarajan had the most memorable one test career ever. Oh, not even close. Look up Rodney Redmond, who was Aaron Redmond's dad. You may have to look up Aaron Redmond, though, at this point. He hasn't played in a while. Who played for New Zealand. Well, both of them played for New Zealand, obviously. Rodney Redmond, he made a lot of runs in his one test. There's the West Indian, whose name I've forgotten, but is it Andy G? I want to say Guanaratna, but that's not right, is it? That sounds like a Sri Lankan name to begin with. But there was a West Indian player. There's also one of the best ones that ever is Fred Tate, Morris Tate's father. So Morris Tate goes on to be a great bowler for England, but his dad played one test. He was picked over someone like Wilfred Rhodes. It may not have been over Wilfred Rhodes, but he was picked over a really good player. So it was a really contentious, you know, pick. You're dropping a great for some guy. He comes in. I'm trying to remember the full situation, but I think when Australia are just edging ahead in the game, England have a chance to shut them out, and Fred Tate drops a really bad catch. And then my memory is Fred Tate is batting at the end as the number 10 or a number 11, and maybe is the last guy to go out as they lose by like two or three runs. I should know. It's 1901 test match, I think. It's an incredible series where there were so many close matches. But the Fred Tate one, I mean, that's incredible. I mean, that was one of those moments in cricket where someone is absolutely remembered for what was one of the worst moments of their life. And obviously his son came back to avenge him. I think, you know, I don't think we'll be talking about T. Natarajan in 120 years time for his first, if he only plays one test, for his only test. Trying to think if I'm missing anyone else. But yeah, New Zealand, West Indies, England, those are the three main ones off the top of my head where someone did something absolutely remarkable and then disappeared. Brighton Coverdale did a great series on one test players. I don't know if you just put in, if you Google Brighton Coverdale one test, some brilliant stories out there. Aditya says, do you think Josh, he's done a Josh, pulled the Josh. Do you think Josh Butler deserves a place in the ODI GOAT discussion? Yes, definitely. He averages 40 plus with a strike rate in excess of 110. These numbers make him one of a kind. And he has 1100s batting outside the top four. Yes, I think if he retires right now, he's certainly not in the top three. I don't think he can move. I don't think he can move any of the top three guys or top four even. So if you've got Viv, AB de Villiers, Sachin and Virat, don't think he enters that. He's probably, if he retires right now, a really interesting one because he goes into that sort of Michael Bevan, MS Dhoni position. The difference is I just think he has more striking numbers than they do. I mean, Michael Bevan's impact on one day cricket was immense and Dhoni's was even more so. Butler's, but their numbers don't look quite as incredible as Butler's do in his era. So from that perspective, I think Butler certainly deserves to be in it. But I think if he's going to get into that top four, you know, probably he probably needs quite a few more years, I would have thought, at the kind of numbers that he's currently doing. He probably just won't play enough one-day cricket, if we're being honest. So that might be the thing that curtails him. But just off the top of my head, I'd find it hard not to have him in the top 10 of all time, I would have thought. And that's completely off the top of my head, you know, of the best, you know, I don't know where he compete. And it's really tricky to compare him to play someone like Javed Mehndar, who, a bit like Michael Bevan, changed the way we played the game. Maybe Butler has as well, Wayne, at this point. I'm not sure. Really good question. Let us have an ad. And when we come back from the ad, I will get to some of the chat questions in the room.
NFL Sunday Ticket is now on YouTube and YouTube TV, which means that you can stay close to your team even if you don't live in their town. Like, maybe you're a Raven who married a Seahawk who got a job in the land of the Falcons. With NFL Sunday Ticket, you can watch your team's out-of-market Sunday afternoon games no matter where you live, because you shouldn't have to change teams even if you change towns. NFL Sunday Ticket, now on YouTube and YouTube TV. Go to youtube.com/presale to get $50 off.
Terms and embargoes apply. Offer ends 9/19. No refund. Subscription auto renews.
Kyle says, what does a successful Major League Cricket debut season look like in terms of viewership or fan penetration within the States? And is a single location tournament here to stay or just a one-year thing? Certainly, that will be a one. Well, I mean, I shouldn't say a one-year thing. They might do it for the first couple of years, but wouldn't imagine that they would want to do that much more than that. So, you know, Major League Cricket would certainly be looking at branching out. A successful season, I know this is going to sound stupid, but that it's broadcast successfully, that people not just in the US watch it, that the players are paid on time, that it's obvious that it's going to have a second season. For a T20 tournament, that is a successful season. I know that sounds absolutely stupid, but that's how low the bar is. I think for Major League Cricket, because of the amount of money involved, I don't know how I wouldn't be too concerned about the TV rights. Sorry, the ground. But you'd want a healthy, you know, I don't even know what success is in the American market, but you'd want between 500,000 and a million people watching the games on TV, at least your key games and perhaps your finals. Streaming, social media, all that sort of stuff matters as well. You want it so that it's part of the T20 conversation, and you also want it at a point where perhaps other markets are starting to watch it a little bit. Even if, I know it doesn't work particularly well for India, but even if you can get, you know, a little bit of, you know, late night watching in the UK, you know, get some people watching in the US, West Indies, a little bit in New Zealand, in Australia, those sorts of things, I think all play a part in helping it make it feel like it's a little bit more successful. But yeah, actual numbers, I don't know where they would be going, but I would want them to have a couple of games where, and I'm not just talking TV numbers, I'm talking about the global streaming / viewership, maybe even radio, if they have radio, of between 500,000 and 1 million a couple of times would be enough. But you'd have to talk to them because they've put so much money into it. So I don't know. It's very hard for me because the economics of the Major League Cricket is so warped compared to a normal T20 season. And more importantly, most T20 seasons, we don't know how many people are watching anyway. We don't know how half of them are successful. That's why I go back to my original thing. Does everyone get paid on time? Does it look like a proper cricket product? Those sorts of things are usually the most important things of the T20 league. And you would assume the Major League Cricket would do most of those fairly well. Jay says, how far are we from seeing a fully fledged continental qualifiers for world events? So, you know, like a World Cup, football World Cup. A while away. I think we need to have good, strong 20 teams. And what do we have now? Maybe 13 to 14 decent teams. I think if we had a good 20 teams, you know, 20 to 25, it gets harder to just give the top teams automatically in the tournament. But I also think it's a ways away. Certainly, I mean, the teams that you're talking about would have to vote for it for themselves. At the moment, that doesn't seem that likely. But as the game continues to grow, maybe US, Japan market get involved, those sorts of things. I think, you know, they'll be quite rightly saying, as it goes ahead, we should get a right to qualify and, you know, not be playing for one or two spots, but be playing for all the spots like everyone else does. But yeah, I can't see that happening anytime soon based on what I know about cricket. All Things Cinema Vodcast says, a very basic question. Since when and why only two fielders are allowed behind square and leg side? I think I saw a comment here saying since Bodyline. That's a very common misconception. Actually, the laws didn't change after Bodyline. Weirdly enough, they didn't even, I wouldn't say Bodyline didn't play a part because I think that would be incorrect, but Bodyline did not play as big a part as you would expect. So Bodyline partly worked because you could put a leg slip, a leg gully, a fine leg and deep backward square, and you could have even more fielders there if you want. You would bowl from very wide in the wicket or even from around the wicket. Bill Vose came from, you know, left arm angle.
and just bowl bouncer, bouncer, bouncer. And of course, people are either fending or they're hooking. And in those days, they didn't have helmets or arm guards. And it just meant a little bit like Neil Wagner with his fields. It just meant that it was kind of inevitable that something was going to go wrong eventually. And with more fielders behind square, meant that any mistake was likely to be picked up. But so body line actually starts before the body line series. The West Indians are the first international team to do it, but I think even some county teams have tried it before then. And it, of course, it makes sense. It's why we still do it now, more or less. You know, bowl at the body, put all the fielders on in one part of the ground, and you know, make the players take risks or try and survive. You know, physically as well. So that, because body line is so badly received, it kind of disappears from cricket straight away. What happens after World War II is we have a lot of off spinners bowling leg stump lines, spinning the ball massively down the leg stump with two leg slips, three, you know, a short fine leg. I think it was a short fine leg because it would have been a catching for the sweep, wouldn't it? And then maybe two guys out for the sweep. And it was horrible, horrible cricket. Absolutely. Most of the law changes they've ever made is just because the cricket has been horrible. Like when people get really upset about catches on the boundary or all these other things, it's like, is it making cricket more horrible to watch? That was. Bowling off spin down the leg side on purpose was about the worst thing you could do. And so one way to stop teams being able to do it was to limit the amount of players behind leg. My memory of it is it had been mentioned before. I think in-swing bowlers had done a similar thing in another period of cricket. And it's terrible. It's terrible, terrible cricket. Try it with your friends if you want. It's just absolutely terrible. And so if you bowl on the offside, you still have the ability to hit the ball on the leg side. Offside play it opens up the game so much more than just leg side play does. And I don't think cricket would be a very big sport if everyone could just dart the ball down the leg side. It's another reason why you can't pitch the ball outside leg stump for LBWs. Because again, bowlers would try and do that, and it takes away all the more attractive parts of batting. It would make it a horrible, stupid game to watch. And again, if you don't believe me, play these rules with your friends, and you will see in 20 minutes why it doesn't work. So that's the history of why there are only two fielders behind square on the leg side. Greeny says, Finch on the mic in the BBL. I haven't heard him actually on any of the games I've watched. How did an Australian great spend 10 years in cricket always under pressure for his spot? Personal reasons versus the media ex-players. No, media ex-players like him. I reckon you've asked about him before, Greeny. When you say an Australian great, he's obviously a fantastic one-day cricketer, but he's not an all-time great. He's just below that level, and he did have weaknesses within his game, and he had long periods where he really did struggle, and he didn't have the Red Bull cricket background, and I think there was always a theory that that meant he wasn't quite as strong as other players. That could be unfair, of course. They could be wrong about that. That's perfectly reasonable. But he did have chinks within his game, and I think that they showed, and he often went through big periods where he didn't do very well and big periods where he did do very well. And we all remember the ones where, you know, he'd walk out and get LBW over and over again, or that the nicking off era he had earlier in his career. He's still a fantastic player, but the Australian batting was fairly deep. There was talent around at all times. There's some very good players in his era that didn't get as much of a go as he did. And I think not playing Test cricket does, especially in Australian cricket, I think you are looked at as a weaker player. I mean, put it this way, Michael Bevan never looked like being dropped. Michael Bevan was an ODI great batter, as we just discussed. And yet, barely talked about anymore. And, you know, the whole conversation has moved on from him. You know, I don't think Finch was a better player than Michael Bevan. And, you know, so all these things matter. Didn't help that he's batting. That's the other thing with opening the batting, I would say. If you open the batting with someone who's slightly better than you, generally, that's, you know, you know, ask Herb Sutcliffe. I mean, there aren't many players like Desmond Haynes was fantastic, but, you know, Langer might be one of the few guys who kind of gets almost boosted at times, considering his record. Swami Nathan says, what explains the sociological phenomenon of subcontinental origin cricketers being spinners in the West? That would be, I would assume, a similar thing that you see in the NFL where different positions in the NFL go to different races based on stereotypical ways that we think about them. We've seen lots of Asian people be good at spin. I think that would be part of it. Oh, it's possible that Asian people have a better background in spin bowling, in that if you come from a family of spin bowl, you know, if you come from a family of Asian cricketers, chances are perhaps they have more of a say. Like, so my dad, for instance, was a cricket coach, but had no idea about spin at all. He didn't know how to bowl it or bat against it or anything. It just was so foreign to him. Whereas he had millions of theories on seam bowling and batting against seam bowling and all those sorts of things. So I think generations come from that. But I do think that there is a typecast element to it. And we see that in cricket in different positions anyway. You know, one of the other famous ones is the, you know, South Africa and their fast bowlers, right? In fact, you might even say West Indies and their fast bowlers, you know, the Asian bowlers compared to, the black bowlers. But in South Africa, we know that, you know, young athletes come through cricket, and even if they show batting talent, quite often if they're tall and athletic, they're pushed into bowling. Those things happen. It's a natural thing. The NFL is really interesting about it. There's a great article I read years ago about all the different positions and how they ended up with different races in each different position. And then also just even when you don't do that, different body types that you do. So I think part of it is probably background, but I think more of it maybe is that sort of typecast situation as well. I'm trying to think. You've got Amla. You've got Khawaja, who you mentioned. I'm trying to think. Nasser Hussain, another Asian batter. I suppose Hamid has come through of recent times. You got players like Vikram Solanki and everyone else. Dav Watmore is another one. So there are Asian players who've played for Western countries as batters as well. You know, Ranji, I suppose, if you want to go back a long way. Dilip Sinha as well. So it would be interesting to have a look at what those numbers are and go back. But yeah, I do think that there is a sort of an inherent bias. And the bias is actually quite often against Western spinners as well, who aren't seen to be canny. They're seen to be a little bit more robotic and they don't have the tricks of the trade. So, and that's what this NFL article was talking about. It's like, weirdly, they've created a situation where there are biases against white players as well, because, you know, white players play this position and black players play this position. Well, that's really limiting. So white players are then funneled into those positions, even if they're not suited towards them, and black players are then funneled into their position. And obviously, that doesn't make as much sense. So it's a really, really interesting question. Having a look at it, I'd have to have a look at the numbers as well to see, you know, how deep it goes. There was also Gurinder Sandhu as well. I'm trying to think of anyone else. I feel like I'm missing another Western. Oh, of course, there's a couple. England have had a few Asian seam bowlers as well. So it's there. I feel like it's been stronger of recent times, but maybe it hasn't. You know, Deepak Patel for New Zealand, would he be one of the first? It's a brilliantly interesting question. Subhash says, is it possible to manipulate DRS and Snicko by the home broadcasters to help the home team? So, yes and no. I have said for a long time that it should be independent. And so you certainly still have that. It's very hard to manipulate, though. What it is possible to withhold, and it is possible to you not be as helpful as you could be. So I think that bias is in it. I've said for ages, it doesn't really make sense. We're going to have neutral umpires everywhere, and then we're going to have a third umpire crew that is not. I think the bigger issue isn't that, although it certainly could play a part. I think the bigger issue is that, and home broadcasters don't show things. There's a reason why people don't get done for tampering the ball at home as much as they do away. I remember a few years ago, I'm still angry at Sky about this. That's probably why Sky never get me on. Jos Buttler had his hands in front of the stumps for a wicket, and they showed it once, and I asked for a replay, and everyone at Sky blanked me forever after that. And it was like, if that was in a way wicketkeeper, they just would have shown it. So those things happen. Not saying that that was, you know, the third umpire wasn't looking at Butler's gloves in that situation, but it should have been shown again. What I would say is third umpires should be specialist umpires. They should be in a bunker working with other specialists in a neutral situation, doing their job that way. That, I think, is a far bigger issue than worrying about this sort of thing, Subhash. But that is something that a no-brainer, and we've already seen it with other sports. Phil says, will Harry Tector go on to become Ireland's greatest all-rounder? Has Harry Tector been bowling? If I missed him, bowling? Look, I think he's got a long way to go as a cricketer. I really, really like him. I wonder what his best format is. I've been thinking about that a lot. Really, really interesting cricketer. But I would say this, unless someone younger comes along who's better, he's a very good chance of being the best batter that Ireland has produced for Ireland. Owen Morgan's probably going to be better than him. Ed Joyce's best years, probably. I know he was around for Ireland, but his best years were probably playing for England as well. Paul Sterling is fantastic. Andy Balburnie's had some really good years. There's some good players there. I think Harry Tector can be the best batter for Ireland in that he'll be around the most and will be able to do the most damage. Josh says, do you think there's an advantage of practicing on an actual pitch with fielders as opposed to in a cage net? Yes. I think in cricket, we don't do it enough. I certainly have pushed for centre wicket practice a lot when I've worked as an analyst. There's usually logistical reasons why you can't do it. And, you know, there's safety concerns as well and all sorts of things. But yes, I think nets is really good when you're grooving your game for one sort of thing. And I think nets are actually really good for first-class cricket and test cricket. One-day cricket and T20, I actually think the match situation and where the fielders are and what the bowler is trying to do is far more important. And I also think you want to see how far the ball has gone, all those sorts of things. I really like match, I was going to call it match practice. I suppose it's, I don't know, centre wicket practice, whatever you want to call it. I really like that and think it should be used more. And I think the players should be sent. It's funny, I was talking to a batting coach recently. A player was going through a lean spell and he was saying, what would you do with him? And I was saying, well, I would send him out into the middle, into this sort of environment that you're talking about and give him 12 balls. And so that's all you have. What can you do with these 12 balls? And by the end, we want you to be smashing it. Because his game was grooved, but you could just tell he just wasn't thinking about T20 cricket the right way when he was going out there, you know, and trying to say to him, you're facing 12 balls every match in your position. Let's see what we can do with the 12 balls today and tomorrow and see what we can learn from that. He was still going to be doing range hitting and probably some throwdowns. He didn't need the nets, was my point. And also the other thing I wanted him to do was really to focus in on what kind of bowlers he was facing, you know, what kind of plans he needed for those sort of bowls. So having two bowlers alternating was a much better thing than having four bowlers in the nets and forgetting what the last bowler had bowled to you and all those sorts of things. Do you think there is a way to normalize batting averages and bowling averages in tests and ODIs to compare them to the golden 1970s generation? I'm not sure the 1970s was golden generation and early 2000. So if you're talking about batting averages, it's called runs above average. That's probably the best metric. The other thing that we look at is, you know, look at specifically a, you know, an opener versus other openers of their era. You get a really good idea. The ODI thing, because you mentioned ODIs as well. The problem with that, of course, is economy rates and how you have to look at that. So, there's an extra part of it. But yeah, runs above average in batting and bowling will tell you pretty much a player's worth more or less over a longer period of time. So far better than just a batting average does, because you can play in a spiked era or a deflated era or whatever it may be. So we use that a lot. We've got a big video series coming out. I suppose it will be towards the end of the India-Australia series or might be after that, or the England-New Zealand series. We're still working on it. I've got Cheyenne Khan working on it with me as well. It's really exciting. And we're looking at ranking. This is just test players, but we're looking at ranking players and coming up with, I don't want to say a definitive list. Well, it won't be a definitive list anyway, because 2 years' time, some other player will join it. But we're trying to come up with a really good metric of what you need to factor in when you're looking at the best players of all time. You know, it's more about the what you need to understand, especially, you know, in some sports, they've been playing a similar amount of games, whereas that's not the case in cricket. So, you know, we kind of have to factor in players who played, you know, 2,000 and 3,000, made 2,000 or 3,000 test runs at times, just because, you know, a war intervened or their country didn't play a lot of test matches in, you know, George Headley's case or whatever that may be. And so, you know, you might have a situation where a player plays as many test matches in an 8-year career as, you know, Jack Hobbs did over, what, 30 years? Felt like 30 years, I'm sure, to him. So it's a really, really interesting one of how you look at, you know, longevity and peak, how many peak years a player had and, you know, averages home and away and averages versus other top order players. You know, do you have to deflate openers a little bit? Because openers usually have a slightly lower average than everyone else. All these sorts of things. It's been really fascinating and fun, and we will get to it. It's really cool. It's a great project to get involved with so far. I'm just going to play one more ad, then I'll just go through the room, and I will mop up anything else, and then we can all go about our lives. We got a super chat from PG Back. Wise, flat, accurate, zero turn spin, not rated by coaches. Are you talking about dart bowlers, PG Back? I'm not exactly sure. I think the spin thing is, sideways spin is probably the easiest thing to see. And if you're not an expert in spin bowling, that's obviously what you're going to go with. But also, traditionally, that's obviously what a spin bowler does, right? They spin the ball away from the bat or, you know, inside the bat. As we learn more about spin bowling, I think we learn a lot about revs on the ball and top spin and drop and everything else. And we're certainly getting more and more information from Hawkeye on that. And then something like, you know, the Rapsodo system they use in baseball would tell us even more about all those sorts of things. In that sort of situation, I would love to go back and use Hawkeye and Rapsodo on someone like Anil Kumble to be able to see why he was so effective in the way that he was. But I think if your question is why do bowlers who don't spin it that much not given as much attention as bowlers who do spin it, it's just because it's easier to see. And generally, that's what we see as being successful. It's kind of not why a spin is successful, if that makes sense. There's a lot of things, but you do have to obviously turn the ball or deviate the ball or be able to deceive in some way or another from that perspective. The other thing is that if you bowl very flat spin, I'm talking more maybe in any form of cricket, if it's not going above the eyes and dropping below the eyes, if it's not dropping massively on a different length because you're not putting a lot of revs on the ball, it's very hard to deceive very top-level players. And eventually, they might score slowly off you for a long period of time, but eventually they will find a way to score off you. You want that ability to be able to drop the ball, move the ball, and everything else. Corrector, La Estrella Disan Esteban. I don't know what any of that means. I once heard there is no very little leg spin in Bangladesh. It is. They actually tried to force leg spinners into every BPL team. Is this true? How did this occur? I think it's because of the kind of wickets they get in Bangladesh where wrist spinners get more overspin and finger spinners get more side spin. And finger spinners usually can bowl a little bit faster than wrist spinners. And certainly have the ability to up their speed much more naturally than wrist spinners do. And so Bangladesh pitchers don't bounce particularly high. And you can bowl quite quickly with your finger spin and still spin the ball around. And the bounce doesn't matter as much. So I think a lot of the natural advantages that wrist spinners have is negated. And also, I think that in general, if you have spinning conditions where the ball's going to spin for a finger spinner regardless, that's a much easier thing to do much more accurately and a little bit faster. Whereas leg spin, you probably need a little bit more assistance off the speed of the wicket. So perhaps that's why, leg spin was maybe most popular at times in places like South Africa and Australia, because you do get a little bit more spin and bounce in those places. Sorry, I don't mean spin and bounce. I mean pace and bounce off the wicket. Nimesh says, do you feel there would be a fundamental difference in Dhoni's batting numbers had he not been thrust into captaining in 2007? Yeah, I think he, yes. I would have to go through the numbers, specifically. Yeah, 100% agree with you. But he came up recently in something I was doing. And yeah, I do think that's right. I think that in that case, you would certainly see a situation where he's a different kind of player, I think, in part because of the leadership. I'm assuming it's because of the leadership, of course. It may not be. Last one from, am I just Mars from the screen today? Or did it's on 80%. Whoops, thought I was going blind.
Vabhav says, do you think England's rotation policy and workload management in some way hindering their potential, particularly in ODIs? No. No. Okay. There are three formats of cricket. You cannot play all three flat out all the time anymore. No one can. No team ever will again. That's gone. International cricket may go, but that part of it is certainly gone. Look at what England have done. Is there are times when they basically sold their test. I mean, the one thing I would say about baseball is the test team wasn't getting to pick from the best players all the time. A lot of their best players were being rested before baseball. Right? That's a really important thing to remember. That certainly played a small part. There were many other reasons why they weren't very good. Their T20 team wasn't particularly very strong for a long period of time. Right? Again, why was that the case? They had other things that they were planning for. The 2019 World Cup was more important. Then you had the T20 World Cups. They knew they had two of them back to back. Suddenly T20 cricket was the most important thing for English cricket. And they were playing it everywhere and, you know, doing it in that way. Now it's one day cricket and they're starting to do that. What the first thing they have to do is work out what their team is. And I'm not sure they know 100% exactly where they're going to go at the moment. Although, you know, Jofra's come back certainly makes things a lot easier for them. And the Ben Stokes thing probably makes things more difficult, but also at least gives them another option. We have to get used to, especially Australia, England, and it will eventually be India, although they're not quite doing it yet, but they're not probably not far away. We have to get used to the best teams peaking for major events, because I think that's what international cricket is going to be from now on. And so I've got no problem with the way that England have been playing and the way that they're thinking about everything at the moment. That doesn't mean they're going to win the World Cup. It doesn't mean that it's even the right way to win it. But if they want to be successful in everything, I think you have to go, okay, well, now we're going to play a lot of one-dayers. Now we're going to play a lot of this. Look at Jason Roy. I think I might have said in a previous podcast, he hadn't played a List A game for Surrey since the last World Cup, 50-over game for Surrey since the last World Cup. These guys aren't playing a lot of it. And so they're probably, you know, they're throwing guys in, seeing what different moves and everything are going to work for them and take it from there. I think this is the future. You know, a whole new level of, well, we don't really have to win these. What we have to do is learn this lesson from these. And we saw with England before that last World Cup, really trying to find the best left arm seamer. And eventually they decided that was Sam Curran and he was player of the tournament. He probably shouldn't have been player of the tournament, but that's another one. Thanks to everyone for a great comment section today. And great work on Patreon as well. Remember, follow your 99.94 podcast if you get a chance. We put a great video up about a stunt person that very few people know, Joffrey Brown. If you watched any action, if you ever watched Jurassic Park or Speed, certainly worth watching that. It was a fantastic story. It was a lot of fun to be able to do. What else do we have? We have the Chris Lynn thing. I'm trying to think what else we have. We have something coming up about Danny van Niekerk. Well, it's actually less about her and more about the entire situation in fitness and cricket. That will be up in the next couple of days and some other really good videos. But we're working on trying to get an India, Australia and the Women's World Cup content going in time for their tournaments, if we can. There's heaps of stuff. I want to do something on Mickey Arthur as well. I might do a couple of different ones on him. I suppose when he takes the Pakistan job, but if/when. But thanks to everyone for listening and everywhere. Remember, you can listen now on Facebook. You can listen on YouTube. You can listen on the podcast network, or you can listen over on Twitter. I'm everywhere. You know, you can listen to me in all four places at once. I think that's possible. Anyway, thanks for everyone who came into the chat and all the questions. And I'll see you again next time. Thanks for listening to Wagon Wheel on 99.94. Remember to download our app or just search for 99.94 where you find podcasts or on YouTube. This show has an ad-free version via Patreon, which also allows you to ask questions before anyone else and many other extras as well. There is a link in the show notes. And if you want more content, well, I have good news for you because we have a lot of things. You can follow us on YouTube where we make all kind of crazy stuff like the complete history of New Zealand opening batters and how Kagiso Rabada was dismissed from a zombie ball. We do a similar thing on TikTok. I also have an emailer that sends out a couple of columns a week, and we run another podcast called Double Century on the History of Cricket. This podcast is hosted by me, Jared Kimber. It is produced by Nick McCorriston. We also have a great support team from 42 with Rati Joshi on socials, Orijoti Sainarpia producing podcasts, Maida Akam producing some of the shows, and Mukunda Banreddy as the head of YouTube content.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And it's your last chance to get more fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this limited-time bundle ends June 30th. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
At Amica Insurance, we know it's more than a life policy. It's about the promise and the responsibility that comes with being a new parent. Being there day and night. And building a plan for tomorrow, today. For the ones you'll always look out for, trust Amica Life Insurance. Amica. Empathy is our best policy.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
When your space has the long-lasting, noticeable scent of Airwick Vibrant Essential Mist, you'll want to invite everyone over. From book club to reality TV watch parties, even the in-laws.
It smells amazing.
Airwick Vibrant Essential Mist is infused with 2 times more essential oil versus regular Airwick Essential Mist for our most authentic, nature-inspired fragrance experience. Airwick Vibrant Essential Mist is perfectly portable and effortlessly easy. The way fragrance should be. Now that's a breath of fresh Airwick.